travelled, there was not a hint of exertion about her. Not a patter of the heart, not a panting of the breath, not a drop of perspiration on her brow. Nor would she emit a giggle or exhibit the slightest smirk. On the contrary, with an expression that was studious, shy, and well-behaved, she would acknowledge the Count with a friendly nod, and looking back at her book, turn the page, demurely. The notion that a child so composed would conspire to the releasing of geese was simply preposterous. One might as well accuse her of toppling the Tower of Babel, or knocking the nose off the Sphinx. True, she had been in the kitchen eating her supper when the chef de cuisine first received word that a certain Swiss diplomat, who had ordered the roast goose, had questioned the freshness of the poultry. And admittedly, she was devoted to her Uncle Emile. Even so, how was a 13-year-old girl to spirit 3 adult fowl to the 4th floor of an international hotel at 7 in the morning without detection? The very idea, concluded the Count, as he opened the door to his rooms, confounded one's reason, offended the laws of nature, and flew in the face of common,
"Yes, O Christi!"
Sophia, who the moment before had been in the lobby, was seated at the Grand Duke's desk, leaning diligently over her tome.
"Oh, hello, Papa," she said without looking up.
"Apparently it is no longer considered polite to look up from one's work when a gentleman enters a room." Sophia turned in her chair.
"I'm sorry, Papa. I was immersed in my reading."
And what might that be?"
"It is an essay on cannibalism."
"An essay on cannibalism?"
"By Michel de Montaigne."
"Ah, yes. Well, that's time well spent, I'm sure," conceded the Count. But as he headed toward the study, he thought, "Michel de Montaigne?" Then he shot a glance at the base of their bureau.
"Is that Anna Karenina?"
Sophia followed his gaze.
"Yes, I believe it is."
"But what is she doing down there?"
"She was the closest in thickness to Montaigne."
"The closest in thickness?"
"Is something wrong?"
"All I can say is that Anna Karenina would never have put you under a bureau just because you happen to be as thick as Montaigne."
"The very idea is preposterous," the Count was saying. "How is a 13-year-old girl to spirit 3 fully grown geese up 2 flights of stairs without the slightest detection? Besides, I ask you, is such behaviour even in her character?"
"Certainly not," said Emile.
"No, not in the least," agreed André. The 3 men shook their heads in shared indignation. One of the advantages of working together for many years is that the daily rigmarole can be dispensed with quickly, leaving ample time for discussions of weightier concerns, such as rheumatism, the inadequacy of public transit, and the petty behaviour of the inexplicably promoted. After 2 decades, the members of the triumvirate knew a thing or two about the small-minded men who sat behind stacks of paper, and the so-called gourmands from Geneva who couldn't tell a goose from a grouse.
"It's outrageous," said the Count. "Unquestionably.
And to summon me 30 minutes before our daily meeting, at which there is never a shortage of important matters to discuss."
"Quite so," agreed André. "Which reminds me, Alexander."
"Yes?"
"Before we open tonight, could you have someone sweep out the dumb waiter?"
"Certainly. Is it a mess?"
"I'm afraid so. It has somehow become littered with feathers."
In saying this, André used one of his legendary fingers to scratch his upper lip, while Emile pretended to sip at his tea. And the Count? He opened his mouth with every intention of making the perfect rejoinder. The sort of remark that, having cut one man to the quick, would be quoted by others for years to come. But there was a knock at the door, and young Ilya entered with his wooden spoon.
Over the course of the Great Patriotic War, Emile had lost the seasoned members of his crew one by one, even the whistling Stanislav. With every able-bodied man eventually in the army, he had been forced to staff his kitchen with adolescents. Thus, Ilya, who had been hired in 1943, had been promoted on the basis of seniority to sous-chef in 1945, at the ripe old age of 19. As a reflection of qualified confidence, Emile had bestowed upon him a spoon in place of a knife.
"Well?"
said Emile, looking up with impatience. In response, Ilya hesitated. Emile looked to the other members of the triumvirate and rolled his eyes, as much as to say,
"You see what I must put up with?"
Then he turned back to his apprentice.
"As anyone can see, we are men with business to attend to. But apparently you have something of such importance that you feel the need to interrupt. Well then, out with it, before we expire from anticipation."
The young man opened his mouth, but then, rather than explain himself, he simply pointed his spoon toward the kitchen. Following the direction of the utensil, the members of the triumvirate looked through the office window, and there, near the door to the back stair, stood an unfortunate-looking soul in a ragged winter coat. At the sight of him, Emile grew crimson.
"Who let him in here?"
"I did, sir."
Emile stood so abruptly he nearly knocked over his chair. Then, just as a commander will tear the epaulettes from the shoulders of an errant officer, Emile grabbed the spoon from Ilya's hand.
"So, you're the commissar of nincompoops now, is that it, eh? When I had my back turned, you were promoted to the general secretary of bunglers?"
The young man took a step back.
"No, sir, I have not been promoted."
Emile smacked the table with the spoon, nearly cracking it in two.
"Of course you haven't. How often have I told you not to let beggars in the kitchen? Don't you see that if you give him a crust of bread today, there will be 5 of his friends here tomorrow, and 50 the day after that?"
"Yes, sir, but..."
But what?"
"He didn't ask for food."
"Eh?"
The young man pointed to the count.
"He asked for Alexander Ilyich."
Andrei and Emile both looked to their colleague in surprise. The count in turn looked through the window at the beggar. Then, without saying a word, he rose from his chair, exited the office, and embraced this boon companion whom he had not seen in 8 long years. Though Andrei and Emile had never met the stranger, as soon as they heard his name, they knew exactly who he was. The one who had lived with a count above the cobbler's shop. The one who had paced 1,000 miles in increments of 15 feet. The lover of Mayakovsky and Mandelstam, who, like so many others, had been tried and sentenced in the name of Article 58.
"Why don't you make yourselves comfortable?"
suggested Andrei, with a gesture of his hand.
"You can use Emile's office."
"Yes," agreed Emile. "By all means, my office."
With his impeccable instincts, Andrei led Mishka to the chair with its back to the kitchen, while Emile placed bread and salt on the table, that ancient Russian symbol of hospitality. A moment later, he returned with a plate of potatoes and cutlets of veal. Then the chef and maitre d' excused themselves, closing the door so that the two old friends could speak undisturbed. Mishka looked at the table.
"Bread and salt,"
he said with a smile. As the count looked across at Mishka, he was moved by two contrary currents of emotion. On the one hand, there was that special joy of seeing a friend from youth unexpectedly, a welcome event no matter when or where, but at the same time, the count was confronted by the irrefutable facts of Mishka's appearance, 30 pounds lighter, dressed in a threadbare coat and dragging one leg behind him. It was no wonder that Emile had mistaken him for a beggar. Naturally, The Count had watched in recent years as age began to take its toll on the triumvirate. He had noticed the occasional tremor in André's left hand and the creeping deafness in Emile's right ear. He had noticed the greying of the former's hair and the thinning of the latter's. But with Mishka, here were not simply the ravages of time. Here were the marks of one man upon another, of an era upon its offspring. Perhaps most striking was Mishka's smile. In their youth, Mishka had been almost earnest to a fault and never spoke with irony. Yet, when he said, "bread and salt," he wore the smile of the sarcast.
"It is so good to see you, Mishka," the Count said after a moment. "I can't tell you how relieved I was when you sent word of your release. When did you return to Moscow?"
"I haven't," his friend replied with his new smile. Upon the dutiful completion of his 8 years, Mishka explained, he had been rewarded with a -6. To visit Moscow, he had borrowed a passport from a sympathetic soul with a passing likeness.
"Is that wise?" the Count asked with concern.
Mishka shrugged.
"I arrived this morning from Yavis by train. I'll be returning to Yavis later tonight."
"Yavis? Where is that?"
"Somewhere between where the wheat is grown and the bread is eaten."
"Are you teaching?"
the Count asked tentatively.
"No," Mishka said with a shake of the head. "We are not encouraged to teach. But then, we are not encouraged to read or write. We are hardly encouraged to eat."
So it was that Mishka began to describe his life in Yavis. And as he did so, he used the first person plural so often that the Count assumed he must have moved there with a fellow inmate from the camps. But slowly, it became clear that in saying "we," Mishka had no one person in mind. For Mishka, "we" encompassed all his fellow prisoners, and not simply those he had known in Arkhangelsk. It encompassed the million or more who had toiled on the Solovetsky Islands, or in the Sevost Lag, or on the White Sea Canal, whether they had toiled there in the '20s or thirties, or toiled there still. Stripped of their names and family ties, of their professions and possessions, herded together in hunger and hardship, the residents of the Gulag, the Zeks, became indistinguishable from one another. That, of course, was part of the point. Not content with the toll exacted by means of incarceration and forced labor in inhospitable climes, the supreme authority sought to efface the enemies of the people. But an unanticipated consequence of this strategy was the creation of a new polis. Having been stripped of their identities, henceforth the Zeks, though millions in number, would move in perfect unison, sharing in their privations as well as their will to persist. Henceforth, they would know each other whenever and wherever they met. They would make room for each other under their roofs and at their tables, addressing each other as brother and sister and friend, but never, ever, under any circumstance, as comrade. Mishka was silent. "It is funny what comes to one at night," he said after a moment. "After dropping our shovels and trudging to the barracks, we would swallow our gruel and pull our blankets to our chins, eager for sleep. But inevitably some unexpected thought would come, some uninvited memory that wanted to be sized up, measured and weighed. And many was the night I found myself thinking of that German you encountered in the bar, the one who claimed that vodka was Russia's only contribution to the West, and who challenged anyone to name three more."
"I remember it well. I borrowed your observation that Tolstoy and Chekhov were the bookends of narrative, invoked Tchaikovsky, and then ordered the brute a serving of caviar."
"That's it."
Mishka shook his head, and then looked at the Count with his smile.
"One night, some years ago, I thought of another Sasha."
A fifth contribution? Yes, a fifth contribution. The burning of Moscow.
The Count was taken aback.
You mean in 1812?
Mishka nodded.
Can you imagine the expression on Napoleon's face when he was roused at 2 in the morning and stepped from his brand new bedroom in the Kremlin, only to find that the city he claimed just hours before had been set on fire by its citizens?
Mishka gave a quiet laugh.
Yes, the burning of Moscow was especially Russian, my friend. Of that there can be no doubt, because it was not a discrete event. It was the form of an event. One example plucked from a history of thousands. For as people, we Russians have proven unusually adept at destroying that which we have created. Perhaps because of his limp, Mishka no longer got up to pace the room, but the Count could see that he was pacing it with his eyes. Every country has its grand canvas, Sasha, the so-called masterpiece that hangs in a hallowed hall and sums up the national identity for generations to come. For the French, it is Delacroix's Liberty Leading the People. For the Dutch, Rembrandt's Night Watch. For the Americans, Washington Crossing the Delaware. And for we Russians, it is a pair of twins. Nikolai Gay's Peter the Great interrogating Alexei, and Ilya Repin's Ivan the Terrible and his son. For decades, these two paintings have been revered by our public, praised by our critics, and sketched by our diligent students of the arts. And yet, what do they depict? In one, our most enlightened Tsar studies his oldest son with suspicion, on the verge of condemning him to death, while in the other, unflinching Ivan cradles the body of his eldest, having already exacted the supreme measure with a swing of the scepter to the head. Our churches, known the world over for their idiosyncratic beauty, for their brightly coloured spires and improbable cupolas, we raise one by one. We topple the statues of old heroes and strip their names from the streets, as if they had been figments of our imagination. Our poets we either silence or wait patiently for them to silence themselves.
Mishka picked up his fork, stuck it in the untouched veal, and raised it in the air.
Do you know that back in 30, when they announced the mandatory collectivization of farming, half our peasants slaughtered their own livestock rather than give them up to the cooperatives? 14 million head of cattle left to the buzzards and flies.
He gently returned the cut of meat to its plate, as if in a show of respect.
How can we understand this, Sasha? What is it about a nation that would foster a willingness in its people to destroy their own artworks, ravage their own cities, and kill their own progeny without compunction? To foreigners, it must seem shocking. It must seem as if we Russians have such a brutish indifference that nothing, not even the fruit of our loins, is viewed as sacrosanct. And how that notion pained me, how it unsettled me, exhausted as I was. The very thought of it could keep me tossing until dawn. Then one night, he came to me in a dream, Sasha. Mayakovsky himself. He quoted some lines of verse, beautiful, haunting lines that I had never heard before, about the bark of a birch tree glinting in the winter sun. Then he loaded his revolver with an exclamation point and put the barrel to his chest. When I awoke, I suddenly understood that this propensity for self-destruction was not an abomination, not something to be ashamed of or abhorred. It was our greatest strength. We turn the gun on ourselves, not because we are more indifferent and less cultured than the British or the French or the Italians. On the contrary, we are prepared to destroy that which we have created because we believe more than any of them in the power of the picture, the poem, the prayer, or the person.
Mishka shook his head.
Mark my words, my friend. We have not burned Moscow to the ground for the last time.
As in the past,
Mishka talked with a fevered intensity, almost as if he were making his points to himself. But once he had spoken his piece, he looked across the table and saw the distressed expression on the Count's face. Then he suddenly laughed in a heartfelt manner, without bitterness or irony, and reached across the table to squeeze his old friend's forearm. "I see that I have unsettled you, Sasha, with my talk of revolvers. But don't worry. I am not through yet. I still have something to attend to. In fact, that is why I slipped into the city, to visit the library for a little project that I am working on." With a sense of relief, the Count recognized the old spark in Mishka's eye, the one that inevitably flashed before he threw himself headlong into a scrape.
"Is it a work of poetry?" asked the Count.
"Poetry? Yes, in a manner of speaking, I suppose it is. But it is also something more fundamental, something that can be built upon. I'm not ready to share it just yet, but when I am, you shall be the first."
By the time they came out of the office and the Count led Mishka to the back stair, the kitchen was in full swing. On the counter were onions being minced, beets being sliced, hens being plucked. From the stove, where six pots simmered, Emil signalled to the Count that he should wait a moment. After wiping his hands on his apron, he came to the door with some food wrapped in brown paper.
"A little something for your journey, Mikhail Fyodorovich."
Mishka looked taken aback by the offering, and for a moment the Count thought his friend was going to refuse it on principle. But Mishka thanked the chef and took the parcel in hand. Andrei was there too now, to express his pleasure at finally meeting Mishka and to wish him well. Having returned the sentiments, Mishka opened the door to the stairwell, but then paused. Having taken a moment to look over the kitchen with all of its activity and abundance, to look from gentle Andrei to heartfelt Emil, he turned to the Count.
"Who would have imagined," he said, "when you were sentenced to life in the metropole all those years ago, that you had just become the luckiest man in all of Russia?"
At 7:30 that evening, when the Count entered the yellow room, Osip tamped out his cigarette and leapt from his chair.
"Ah, here you are, Alexander. I thought a quick trip to San Francesco was in order. We haven't been back in a year. Get the lights, will you?"
As Osip hurried to the back of the room, the Count absently took his seat at the table for two and put his napkin in his lap.
"Alexander."
The Count looked back.
"Yes? The lights. Oh, my apologies."
The Count rose, switched off the lights, and lingered by the wall.
"Are you going to take your seat again?" asked Osip. "Ah, yes, of course."
The Count returned to the table and sat in Osip's chair.
"Is everything all right, my friend? You do not seem yourself."
"No, no," assured the Count with a smile.
"Everything is excellent. Please, proceed."
Osip waited for a moment to be sure, then he threw the switch and hurried back to the table as the grand old shadows began to flicker on the dining room wall. 2 months after what Osip liked to refer to as the de Tocqueville affair, he had appeared in the yellow room with a projector and an uncensored print of A Day at the Races. From that night onward, the two men left the tomes of history on the bookshelves where they belonged and advanced their studies of America through the medium of film. Osip Ivanovich had actually mastered the English language right down to the past perfect progressive as early as 1939. But American movies still deserve their careful consideration, he argued, not simply as windows into Western culture, but as unprecedented mechanisms of class repression. For with cinema, the Yanks had apparently discovered how to placate the entire working class
at the cost of a nickel a week. "Just look at their depression," he said. "From beginning to end, it lasted 10 years, an entire decade in which the proletariat was left to fend for itself, scrounging in alleys and begging at chapel doors. If ever there had been a time for the American worker to cast off the yoke, surely that was it. But did they join their brothers in arms? Did they shoulder their axes and splinter the doors of the mansions? Not even for an afternoon. Instead, they shuffled to the nearest movie house, where the latest fantasy was dangled before them like a pocket watch at the end of a chain. Yes, Alexander, it behooves us to study this phenomenon with the utmost diligence and care." So study it they did. And the Count could confirm that Ossip approached the task with the utmost diligence and care, for when a movie was playing, he could hardly sit still. During the westerns, when a fight broke out in a saloon, he would clench his fists, fend off a blow, give a left to the gut, and an uppercut to the jaw. When Theodore Astaire danced with Ginger Rogers, his fingers would open wide and flutter about his waist, while his feet shuffled back and forth on the carpet. And when Bela Lugosi emerged from the shadows, Ossip leapt from his seat and nearly fell to the floor. Then, as the credits rolled, he would shake his head with an expression of moral disappointment. "Shameful," he would say. "Scandalous. Insidious." Like the seasoned scientist, Ossip would coolly dissect whatever they had just observed. The musicals were pastries designed to placate the impoverished with daydreams of unattainable bliss. The horror movies were sleights of hand in which the fears of the workingman have been displaced by those of pretty girls. The vaudevillian comedies were preposterous narcotics. And the westerns? They were the most devious propaganda of all, fables in which evil is represented by collectives who rustle and rob, while virtue is a lone individual who risks his life to defend the sanctity of someone else's private property. In sum, Hollywood is the single most dangerous force in the history of class struggle. Or so Ossip argued, until he discovered the genre of American movies that would come to be known as film noir. With rapt attention, he watched the likes of This Gun for Hire, Shadow of a Doubt, and Double Indemnity. "What is this?" he would ask of no one in particular. "Who is making these movies? Under what auspices?" From one to the next, they seemed to depict an America in which corruption and cruelty lounged on the couch, in which justice was a beggar and kindness a fool, in which loyalties were fashioned from paper and self-interest was fashioned from steel. In other words, they provided an unflinching portrayal of capitalism as it actually was. "How did this happen, Alexander? Why do they allow these movies to be made? Do they not realize they are hammering a wedge beneath their own foundation stones?" But no single star of the genre captivated Ossip more than Humphrey Bogart. With the exception of Casablanca, which Ossip viewed as a woman's movie, they had watched all of Bogart's films at least twice, whether in The Petrified Forest, To Have and Have Not, or especially The Maltese Falcon. Ossip appreciated the actor's hardened looks, his sardonic remarks, his general lack of sentiment. "You notice how in the first act he always seems so removed and indifferent. But once his indignation is roused, Alexander, there is no one more willing to do what is necessary, to act clear-eyed, quick, and without compunction. Here truly is a man of intent." In the yellow room, Ossip took 2 mouthfuls of Emile's braised veal with caviar sauce, a gulp of Georgian wine, and looked up just in time to see the image of the Golden Gate Bridge. In the minutes that followed, once again the services of Sam Spade were enlisted by the alluring, if somewhat mysterious, Miss Wonderly,
Once again, Spade's partner was gunned down in an alley just hours before Floyd Thursby met a similar fate. And once again, Joel Cairo, the fat man, and Bridget O'Shaughnessy, having surreptitiously joined forces, drugged Spade's whiskey and headed for the wharf, their elusive quest finally within reach. But even as Spade was nursing his head, a stranger in a black coat and hat stumbled into his office, dropped a bundle to the floor, and collapsed dead on the couch.
"Do you think Russians are particularly brutish, Ossip?"
asked the Count.
"What's that?"
Ossip whispered, as if there were others in the audience whom he didn't want to disturb.
"Do you think we are essentially more brutish than the French, or the English, or these Americans?"
"Alexander!"
Ossip hissed, as Spade was washing the stranger's blood from his hands.
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"I mean, do you think we are more apt than others to destroy that which we have created?"
Ossip, who had not yet torn his eyes from the screen, now turned to stare at the Count in disbelief. Then he abruptly rose, stomped to the projector, and froze the film at the very moment that Spade, having placed the roughly wrapped bundle on his desk, was taking his penknife from his pocket.
"Is it possible that you don't see what is happening?"
he demanded while pointing at the screen.
"Having travelled from the Orient to the docks of San Francisco, Captain Jacoby has been shot 5 times. He has jumped from a burning ship, stumbled through the city, and used his final breaths to bring Comrade Spatsky this mysterious package wrapped in paper and bound in string. And you choose this moment to engage in metaphysics."
The Count, who had turned around, was holding up a hand to cut the glare from the projection.
"But Ossip," he said, "we have watched him open the bundle on at least 3 occasions. What difference does that make?"
"You have read Anna Karenina at least 10 times, but I'd wager you still cry when she throws herself under the train."
"That's something else altogether." "Is it?"
There was silence. Then, with an expression of exasperation, Ossip turned off the projector. He flicked on the lights and returned to the table.
"All right, my friend. I can see that you are vexed by something. Let's see if we can make sense of it, so we can get on with our studies."
Thus, the Count described for Ossip the conversation he'd had with Mishka. Or rather, he relayed Mishka's views on the burning of Moscow, and the toppling of statues, and the silencing of poets, and the slaughter of 14 million head of cattle. Ossip, having already aired his frustrations, now listened to the Count attentively, occasionally nodding his head at Mishka's various points.
"All right," he said, once the Count had finished. "So, what is it exactly that is bothering you, Alexander? Does your friend's assertion shock you? Does it offend your sensibilities? I understand that you are worried about his state of mind, but isn't it possible that he is right in his opinions while being wrong in his sentiments?"
"What do you mean?"
"It is like the Maltese Falcon."
"Ossip, please."
"No, I'm quite serious. What is the blackbird if not a symbol of Western heritage itself? A sculpture fashioned by knights of the Crusades from gold and jewels as tribute to a king. It is an emblem of the church and the monarchies, those rapacious institutions that have served as the foundation for all of Europe's art and ideas. Well, who is to say that their love of that heritage isn't as misguided as the fat man's for his falcon? Perhaps that is exactly what must be swept aside before their people can hope to progress."
His tone grew softer.
"The Bolsheviks are not Visigoths, Alexander. We are not the barbarian hordes descending upon Rome and destroying all that is fine out of ignorance and envy. It is the opposite. In 1916, Russia was a barbarian state. It was the most illiterate nation in Europe.
with the majority of its population living in modified serfdom, tilling the fields with wooden ploughs, beating their wives by candlelight, collapsing on their benches drunk with vodka, and then waking at dawn to humble themselves before their icons. That is, living exactly as their forefathers had lived 500 years before. Is it not possible that our reverence for all the statues and cathedrals and ancient institutions was precisely what was holding us back? Ossip paused, taking a moment to refill their glasses with wine. But where do we stand now? How far have we come? By marrying American tempo with Soviet aims, we are on the verge of universal literacy. Russia's long-suffering women, our second serfdom, have been elevated to the status of equals. We have built whole new cities, and our industrial production outpaces that of most of Europe. But at what cost? Ossip slapped the table. At the greatest cost! But do you think the achievements of the Americans, envied the world over, came without a cost? Just ask their African brothers. And do you think the engineers who designed their illustrious skyscrapers or built their highways hesitated for one moment to level the lovely little neighborhoods that stood in their way? I guarantee you, Alexander, they laid the dynamite and pushed the plungers themselves. As I've said to you before, we and the Americans will lead the rest of this century because we are the only nations who have learned to brush the past aside instead of bowing before it. But where they have done so in service of their beloved individualism, we are attempting to do so in service of the common good. When he parted company with Ossip at 10, rather than climbing the stairs to the 6th floor, the Count headed to the Shalyapin in the hopes of finding it empty. But as he entered the bar, he discovered a raucous group composed of journalists, members of the diplomatic corps, and two of the young hostesses in their little black dresses. And at the center of the commotion, for the third night in a row, was the American general's aide-de-camp. Hunched over with his arms outstretched, shifting back and forth on the balls of his feet, he was relaying his tale like a wrestler on the mat. Sidestepping the Monsignor, old Porterhouse slowly advanced upon the second goose, waiting for his prey to look him in the eye. That's the secret, you see, the looking in the eye. That's the moment Porterhouse lets his adversaries imagine for a second that they are his equals. Having taken two steps to the left, Porterhouse suddenly took three to the right. Thrown off balance, the goose met the old boy's gaze. And that's when Porterhouse leapt. The aide-de-camp leapt. The two hostesses shrieked, then giggled. When the aide-de-camp stood back to his full height, he was holding a pineapple. With one hand around its throat and the other under its tail, the captain displayed the fruit for all to see, just as the general had displayed the second goose. And it was at this fateful juncture that the good general's sash unsashed and his robe disrobed, revealing a regulation pair of U.S. Army issue briefs, at the sight of which Madame Velashky fainted. As the audience applauded, the aide-de-camp gave a bow. Then he set the pineapple gently on the bar and lifted his drink.
"Madame Velashky's response seems perfectly understandable," said one of the journalists. "But what did you do when you saw the old man's briefs?"
"What did I do?" exclaimed the aide-de-camp. "Why, I saluted them, of course."
As the others laughed, he emptied his drink.
"Now, gentlemen, I suggest we head out into the night. I can tell you from personal experience that over at the National can be heard the sorriest samba in the Northern Hemisphere. The drummer, who is blind in one eye, can't hit his cymbals, and the band leader hasn't the slightest sense of a Latin tempo. The closest he has come to South America is when he fell down a flight of mahogany stairs. But he has excellent intentions and a toupee that has descended from heaven."
With that, the motley assembly stumbled into the night, leaving the Count to approach the bar in relative peace and quiet.
Good evening, Odrius.
Good evening, Count Rostov. What is your pleasure?
A glass of Armagnac, perhaps.
A moment later, as the Count gave the brandy in his snifter a swirl, he found himself smiling at the aide-de-camp's portrayal, which in turn led him to reflect on the personality of Americans in general. In his persuasive fashion, Ossip had argued that during the Depression, Hollywood had undermined the inevitable forces of revolution by means of its elaborate chicanery. But the Count wondered if Ossip didn't have his analysis upside down. Certainly, it seemed true that glittering musicals and slapstick comedies had flourished during the 1930s in America. But so, too, had jazz and skyscrapers. Were these also narcotics designed to put a restless nation to sleep? Or were they signs of a native spirit so irrepressible that even a depression couldn't squelch it? As the Count gave another swirl of his brandy, a customer sat three stools to his left. To the Count's surprise, it was the aide-de-camp. Ever attentive, Odrius leaned with his forearm on the bar.
"Welcome back, Captain."
"Thank you, Odrius.
What can I do for you?"
"Same as before, I suppose."
As Odrius turned away to prepare the drink, the Captain drummed his hands on the bar and looked idly about. When he met the Count's gaze, he gave a nod and a friendly smile.
"You are not headed for the National?"
the Count couldn't help but ask.
"It seems my friends were in such a hurry to accompany me that they left me behind,"
the American replied. The Count gave a sympathetic smile.
"I'm sorry to hear it."
"No, please don't be. I'm quite fond of being left behind. It always gives me a whole new perspective on wherever it was I thought I was leaving. Besides, I'm off first thing in the morning to head home for a spell, so it's probably for the best."
He extended his hand to the Count.
"Richard van der Weyl.
Alexander Rostov."
The Captain gave another friendly nod and then, having looked away, suddenly looked back.
"Weren't you my waiter last night at the Boyarsky?"
"Yes, I was."
The Captain let out a sigh of relief.
"Thank God. Otherwise I would have had to cancel my drink."
As if on cue, Odrius placed it on the bar. The Captain took a sip and gave another sigh, this one of satisfaction. Then he studied the Count for a moment.
"Are you Russian?"
"To the core."
"Well then, let me say at the outset that I am positively enamored with your country. I love your funny alphabet and those little pastries stuffed with meat. But your nation's notion of cocktail is rather unnerving."
"How so?"
The Captain pointed discreetly down the bar to where a bushy-eyebrowed apparatchik was chatting with a young brunette. Both of them were holding drinks in a striking shade of magenta.
"I gather from Odrius that that concoction contains 10 different ingredients. In addition to vodka, rum, brandy, and grenadine, it boasts an extraction of rose, a dash of bitters, and a melted lollipop. But a cocktail is not meant to be a melange. It is not a potpourri or an Easter parade. At its best, a cocktail should be crisp, elegant, sincere, and limited to 2 ingredients."
"Just 2?"
"Yes, but they must be 2 ingredients that complement each other, that laugh at each other's jokes and make allowances for each other's faults, and that never shout over each other in conversation. Like gin and tonic," he said, pointing to his drink. "Or bourbon and water. Or whiskey and soda."
Shaking his head, he raised his glass and drank from it.
"Excuse me for expounding."
"That's quite all right."
The Captain nodded in gratitude, but then after a moment inquired,
"Do you mind if I make an observation? I mean, of the personal sort."
"Not at all," said the Count.
The Captain slid his drink down the bar
and moved a stool closer. You seem like something is weighing on your mind. I mean, you set that brandy in motion about half an hour ago. If you're not careful, the vortex you've created will drill a hole right through the floor and we'll all end up in the basement. The Count set the snifter down with a laugh. I suppose you're right. Something must be weighing on my mind.
Well then, said Richard, gesturing to the empty bar, you have come to the right place. Since days of old, well-mannered men have assembled in watering holes such as this one in order to unburden themselves in the company of sympathetic souls.
Or strangers? The captain raised a finger in the air.
There are no more sympathetic souls than strangers. So, what say we skip the preambling?
Is it women? Money? Writer's block? The Count laughed again, and then, like other well-mannered men since days of old, he unburdened himself to this sympathetic soul. He described Mishka and his notion that Russians were somehow unusually adept at destroying that which they have created. Then he described Osip and his notion that Mishka was perfectly right, but that the destruction of monuments and masterpieces was essential to the progress of a nation.
Oh, so that's it, said the captain,
as if this would have been his fourth guess.
Yes, but what conclusions would you draw from it all? Asked the Count.
What conclusions? Richard took a drink.
I think that both of your friends are very sharp. I mean, it takes a good bit of dexterity to pull a thread out of the fabric all in one piece. But I can't help feeling that they're missing something.
He drummed his fingers on the bar as he tried to formulate his thoughts.
I understand that there is a little history of dismantling here in Russia, and that the razing of a beautiful old building is bound to engender a little sorrow for what's gone, and some excitement for what's to come. But when all is said and done, I can't help suspecting that grand things persist. Take that fellow, Socrates. 2,000 years ago, he wandered around the marketplace sharing his thoughts with whomever he bumped into, and he wouldn't even take the time to write them down. Then, in something of a fix, he punched his own ticket, pulled his own plug, collapsed his own umbrella. Adios, adieu, fini. Time marched on, as it will. The Romans took over, then the barbarians, and then we threw the whole Middle Ages at him. Hundreds of years of plagues and poisonings and the burning of books. And somehow, after all of that, the grand things this fellow happened to say in the marketplace are still with us. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that as a species, we're just no good at writing obituaries. We don't know how a man or his achievements will be perceived 3 generations from now, any more than we know what his great-great-grandchildren will be having for breakfast on a Tuesday in March. Because when fate hands something down to posterity, it does so behind its back.
They were both silent for a moment. Then the captain emptied his glass and pointed a finger at the Count's brandy.
Tell me, though, is that thing pulling its weight?
When the Count left the Shalyapin an hour later, having joined Captain Vanderweil for 2 rounds of Odrius's magenta-coloured concoction, he was surprised to see Sophia still reading in the lobby. Catching her eye, he gave a little wave, and she gave a little wave back before returning to her book, demurely. It took all of the Count's presence of mind to cross the lobby at a stroll. With the undeniable appearance of a man at ease, he carefully mounted the stairs and slowly began to ascend. But the moment he turned the corner, he broke into a sprint. As he vaulted upward, he could barely contain his sense of glee. The hidden genius of Sophia's game had always been that she chose when it was played. Naturally, she would wait for those moments when he was distracted or off his guard, such that the game was generally over before he even knew it had begun. But tonight, things were going to be different. because by the casualness of Sophia's wave, the Count could tell the game was afoot.
"I've got her now,"
he thought, as he passed the second floor with a sinister little laugh. But as he turned the landing on the third floor, he was forced to acknowledge a second advantage that Sophia had in this game: her youth. For without question, his pace had begun to slow considerably. If his shortness of breath was any indication, he would be crawling by the time he reached the sixth floor, assuming he reached it alive. To be on the safe side, when he got to the fifth floor, he slowed his pace to a purposeful walk. Opening the door to the belfry, he paused to listen. Looking down the stairs, he couldn't see a thing. Could she have already flown past? Impossible. She hadn't the time. Still, on the off chance that she had transported herself by means of witchcraft, the Count climbed the final flight on the tips of his toes, and when he opened their door, he did so with an effect of indifference, only to find that, in fact, the room was empty. Rubbing his hands together, he wondered, "Where should I place myself?" He considered climbing into bed and acting like he was asleep, but he wanted to see the expression on her face. So he sat in the desk chair, tilted it back on two legs, and grabbed the closest book at hand, which happened to be Monsieur Montaigne. Opening the tome at random, he landed on the essay of The Education of Children.
"Just so," he said with a wily smile.
Then he adopted an expression of perfect erudition as he pretended to read. But after 5 minutes, she hadn't appeared.
"Ah, well, I must have been mistaken,"
he was conceding with some disappointment when the door flung open. But it wasn't Sophia. It was one of the chambermaids, in a state of distress.
"Elena, what is it?"
"It's Sophia. She has fallen."
The Count leapt from his chair.
"Fallen? Where?"
"In the service stair."
The Count brushed past the chambermaid and bolted down the belfry. After two flights of empty stairs, a voice in some corner of his mind began to reason that Elena must have been mistaken. But as he rounded the third floor landing, there Sophia was, splayed across the steps, her eyes closed, her hair matted with blood.
"Oh, my God!"
The Count fell to his knees.
"Sophia!"
She didn't respond. Gently raising her head, the Count could see the gash above her brow. Her skull did not appear compromised, but she was bleeding and unconscious. Elena was behind him now, in tears.
"I will go for a doctor,"
she said. But it was after 11. Who could say how long that would take? The Count slid his arms under Sophia's neck and knees, lifted her off the steps, and carried her down the remaining flights. At the ground floor, he pushed the door open with his shoulder and cut through the lobby. Only in the most remote sense was he aware of a middle-aged couple waiting for the elevator, of Vasily at his desk, of voices in the bar. And suddenly, he found himself on the steps of the Metropole in the warm summer air, for the first time in over 20 years. Rodion, the night doorman, looked at the Count in shock.
"A taxi," the Count said. "I need a taxi."
Over the doorman's shoulder, he could see four of them parked 50 feet from the entrance, waiting for the last of the Shalyapin's customers. Two drivers at the front of the line were smoking and chatting. Before Rodion could raise his whistle to his lips, the Count was running toward them. When the drivers noted the Count's approach, the expression on one's face was a knowing smirk, and on the other's, a look of condemnation, having both concluded that the gentleman had a drunken girl in his arms. But they stood to attention when they saw the blood on her face.
"My daughter," said the Count.
"Here,"
said one of the drivers, throwing his cigarette on the ground and running to open the back door of the cab.
"To St. Anselm's,"
said the Count.
"St. Anselm's? As fast as you can."
Putting the car in gear, the driver pulled onto Theatre Square and headed north as the Count, pressing a folded handkerchief against Sophia's wound with one hand and combing her hair with the other,
murmured assurances that went unheard, while the streets of the city raced past unregarded. In a matter of minutes, the cab came to a stop.
"We're here," said the driver.
He got out and opened the back door. The Count carefully slipped out with Sophia in his arms, then suddenly stopped.
"I have no money," he said.
"What money? For God's sake, go!"
The Count crossed the curb and rushed toward the hospital, but even as he passed through its doors, he knew that he had made a terrible mistake. In the entry hall, there were grown men sleeping on benches, like refugees in a railway station. Hallway lights flickered as if powered by a faulty generator, and in the air was the smell of ammonia and cigarette smoke. When the Count had been a young man, St. Anselm's had been among the finest hospitals in the city. But that was 30 years ago. By now, the Bolsheviks had presumably built new hospitals, modern, bright, and clean, and this old facility had been left behind as some sort of clinic for veterans, the homeless, and the otherwise forsaken. Sidestepping a man who appeared to be asleep on his feet, the Count approached a desk where a young nurse was reading.
"It is my daughter," he said. "She has been injured."
Looking up, the nurse dropped her magazine. She disappeared through a door. After what seemed like an eternity, she returned with a young man in the white jacket of an internist. The Count held Sophia out while pulling back the blood-soaked handkerchief to show the wound. The internist ran his hand across his mouth.
"This girl should be seen by a surgeon," he said.
"Is there one here?"
"What? No, of course not."
He looked at a clock on the wall.
"At 6, perhaps."
"At 6? Surely she needs attention now. You must do something."
The internist rubbed his hand across his mouth again, and then turned to the nurse.
"Find Dr. Krasnikov. Have him report to surgery 4.
As the nurse disappeared again, the internist wheeled over a gurney.
"Lay her here and come with me."
With the Count at his side, the internist pushed Sophia down a hall and into an elevator. Once on the third floor, they passed through a pair of swinging doors into a long hallway, in which there were 2 other gurneys, each with a sleeping patient.
"In there."
The Count pushed open the door, and the internist wheeled Sophia into surgery 4. It was a cold room, tiled from floor to ceiling. In one corner, the tiles had begun falling from the plaster. There was a surgical table, craning lights, and a standing tray. After some minutes, the door opened, and an ill-shaven physician entered with the young nurse. He looked as if he had just been wakened.
"What is it?"
he said in a weary voice. "A young girl with a head injury, Dr. Krasnikov."
"All right, all right," he said.
Then, waving a hand at the Count, he added,
"No visitors in the surgery."
The internist took the Count by the elbow.
Wait a second," the Count said. "Is this man capable?"
Looking at the Count, Krasnikov grew red in the face.
"What did he say?"
The Count continued to address the young internist.
"You said she needed to be seen by a surgeon. Is this man a surgeon?" "Get him out of here, I tell you!"
shouted Krasnikov. But the door to the surgery swung open again, and a tall man in his late 40s entered in the company of a primly dressed associate.
"Who is in charge here?"
he asked.
"I am in charge," said Krasnikov. "Who are you? What is this?"
Brushing Krasnikov aside, the newcomer approached the table and leaned over Sophia. He gingerly parted her hair to examine the wound. He raised one of her eyelids with a thumb, and then took her pulse by holding her wrist and glancing at his watch. Only then did he turn to Krasnikov.
"I'm Lazovsky, chief of surgery at First Municipal. I will be seeing to this patient." "What's that? Now listen here."
Lazovsky turned to the Count.
"Are you Rostov?"
"Yes,"
said the Count, astounded.
"Tell me when and how this happened. Be as precise as you can."
"She fell while running up a staircase. I think she hit her head on the edge of the landing. It was at the Metropole Hotel. It couldn't have been more than 30 minutes ago. Had she been drinking?
What? No, she's a child.
How old?
13.
Her name?